Okay, let's unpack this. I mean, imagine taking a people from, well, from bitter bondage to becoming this divinely guided nation, complete with laws, leadership, even a portable sanctuary representing God's presence right there with them. That's the kind of extraordinary journey we're embarking on today.
It really is.
Our source material for this deep dive is the foundational narrative from the book of Exodus. It details, the origin story of a people, their liberation, and how their foundational laws and practices were formed.
Yeah, and what's truly fascinating here is just the sheer scale of this narrative. You're tracking this immense transformation. It starts with a small family migrating into Egypt
Right.
and ends up with an entire multitude establishing a covenant with the divine, building this elaborate mobile sacred space. It's not just a story of liberation. It's really about establishing a complete societal framework, pretty much from the ground up.
And our mission today really is to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge, maybe some surprising facts, and profound insights from this really rich and detailed account, specifically curated for you, our curious listener, to help you quickly grasp the essence of this, well, complex and a really impactful text. So we begin right at the start. Jacob's family, a modest 70 souls strong, settling in Egypt, and Joseph's already a big deal there. What's striking, though, is how this small group just rapidly grew in number.
Indeed. I mean, this immense growth, the text describes it as being fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty. Basically, they became incredibly numerous and powerful.
Okay.
But this very prosperity, it actually ignited fear in a new Egyptian king who knew not Joseph.
Oh, okay.
And this fear, this is what drove Pharaoh's initial strategies, what he considered wise from his perspective,
Yeah.
but ultimately oppressive. He's thinking, look, these Israelites are more and mightier than we are. We need to deal wisely with them before they multiply even more, maybe join our enemies in a war and leave.
Right. So the first phase of oppression was imposing taskmasters, forced labor, building these treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses.
Exactly.
But here's the kind of the profound irony. The text says the more they were afflicted, the more they actually multiplied and grew. It completely backfired on the Egyptians.
Precisely. Which, of course, then led to escalating cruelty.
Yeah.
Their lives were made, quote, bitter with hard bondage, in mortar and in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. It adds, all their service, wherein they made them serve, was with rigor. It paints a really stark picture of severe, unrelenting servitude.
And then came that truly chilling decree, ordering the Hebrew midwives, Shiphrah and Puah, to kill all male infants at birth. But the source explicitly highlights their defiance. It says, "The midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive." And when Pharaoh questioned them, their explanation was pretty clever, quick-witted, really. They said, "The Hebrew women are lively and are delivered ere the midwives come in unto them."
Right, a bit of fast thinking there.
And the text says God dealt well with them for their courage.
Yeah, this quiet defiance, rooted in their reverence for God, it eventually pushed Pharaoh to his most desperate and brutal command. Every son that is born, ye shall cast into the river. And this sets the immediate life or death backdrop for the birth of, well, the central figure in the narrative.
Which brings us to Moses himself, and his birth story is just incredibly dramatic. His mother hid him for 3 months, but when she couldn't hide him any longer, she placed him in this little ark made of bulrushes, sealed it with bitumen and pitch, and set it by the river's brink. His sister watched from afar, to see what would happen.
And this is where you witness this really remarkable turn of events. Pharaoh's daughter finds the weeping infant. She
Oh.
shows him compassion, and then through the sister's quick thinking, Moses is miraculously nursed by his own mother.
Incredible.
He's then brought up as the princess's son and named Moses, meaning drawn out of the water.
Let's grow up.
It's a real aha moment, A powerful twist of fate right at the start of his life.
So, fast forward to Moses' adulthood. He became deeply aware of his brethren's burdens, saw an Egyptian assaulting a Hebrew, killed the Egyptian,
Yeah, stepped in.
and then had to flee to the land of Midian when his deed became known.
Right. And his life in Midian, the text details his encounter at the well with the daughters of the priest of Midian, Reuel, who's also called Jethro.
Okay.
Moses helped them, ended up marrying Zipporah, one of the daughters, and they had a son, Gershom. That name means a stranger in a strange land. This whole period of exile and family life tending Jethro's flock, it's really crucial for his transformation, his preparation for what was still to come.
And then comes that absolutely seminal event, God appearing to Moses. In a flame of fire from the middle of a bush on Mount Horeb, a bush that burned but wasn't consumed.
The burning bush, yeah.
And it's Moses' curiosity, his act of turning aside to see this great sight, that's precisely what initiates this profound divine encounter.
And God's revelation here is incredibly powerful. He identifies himself as I am that I am, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God declares very clearly that he has surely seen the affliction of his people and heard their cry. His intention, he states, is to deliver them to a good land and a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey. This sets the entire purpose for Moses' really daunting mission.
But Moses' initial response is, well, it's profound reluctance, serious self-doubt. He asks, who am I that I should go on to Pharaoh?
Mm-hmm. Understandable.
And he worries that they will not believe me. And his claim of being slow of speech and of a slow tongue, that feels highly relatable for anyone asked to do something so huge.
Absolutely. And to address that, God provides three powerful signs to convince the Israelites. Moses' shepherd's rod turns into a serpent.
Okay.
His hand becomes leprous and then whole again.
Wow.
And river water turns to blood. But crucially, God also addresses Moses' perceived lack of eloquence by appointing his brother Aaron as his spokesman. God says, I know that he can speak well. He shall be thy spokesman unto the people. It shows this divine understanding of human limitations and provides for them.
So, with Aaron now by his side, Moses returns to Egypt. And their initial efforts, performing the signs, they are successful in convincing the Israelite elders and the people.
Right, initially. And then comes their first direct confrontation with Pharaoh. They go in and demand that he let God's people go to hold a feast in the wilderness.
Yeah.
And Pharaoh's defiant retort immediately sets the stage for the epic struggle that follows. He says, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I know not the Lord, neither will I let Israel go. That declaration of ignorance and defiance is like the gauntlet being thrown down.
And Pharaoh's countermeasure is immediate and harsh. No more straw provided for brick making.
Might get harder.
Yet the full quarter of bricks must still be met. The Israelite officers, they get beaten for not meeting these impossible quotas. And then they blame Moses and Aaron for making their situation even worse in Pharaoh's eyes, making their savor to be abhorred, as the text puts it.
And this actually leads to Moses' own moment of deep doubt. He complains to God, saying, Lord, wherefore hast thou so evil entreated this people? Why is it that thou hast sent me?
Mm.
But God's reassurance is powerful. He emphasizes his divine identity, the covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and his promise to redeem Israel with a stretched out arm and with great judgments. It serves as this powerful reminder, both to Moses and, you know, to us listening, of the unwavering divine commitment to the plan, even when things look bleak.
And then begins the sequence of the 10 plagues, escalating demonstrations of divine power against Pharaoh and Egypt. God even states he will harden Pharaoh's heart so his wonders can be multiplied.
Right. It starts with Aaron's rod turning into a serpent and swallowing the Egyptian magician's rods, a clear show of supremacy.
Okay.
Then the Nile, Egypt's lifeblood, is turned to blood, kills the fish, makes the water undrinkable.
Devastating.
Next, swarms of frogs invade everything, houses, ovens, everywhere. Pharaoh even makes a temporary plea for relief, but then hardens his heart again.
Right. A pattern starts.
Exactly. Following this, dust becomes lice on man and beast, and this is a plague the Egyptian magicians cannot replicate. They actually acknowledge it as the finger of God.
Ah, interesting. They recognize it.
They do. And this divine distinction becomes even clearer as the plagues continue and differentiate. Swarms of flies infest Egyptian houses and the ground, but the land of Goshen, where the Israelites lived, was specifically spared.
A clear separation.
Definitely. Then comes a grievous livestock disease, a murrain, a deadly pestilence, killing all Egyptian cattle, horses, asses, camels, oxen, and sheep, but not one Israelite animal died.
Wow. The contrast is stark.
Incredibly stark. Next, ashes sprinkled into the air cause painful boils with blains, these inflamed sores, on man and beast throughout Egypt. It even affects the magicians themselves.
Even the magician.
Then an unprecedented, really grievous hail mingled with fire destroys people, animals, plants, trees again, sparing Goshen. Pharaoh admits sin, says the Lord is righteous and I and my people are wicked. But his heart hardens again as soon as the hail stops.
It's almost unbelievable, his resistance. And it continues.
Oh, yes. Building on that, an east wind brings these vast swarms of locusts. They cover the land and devour every single green thing that the hail had left. Pharaoh hurries to plead for forgiveness again. But the Lord hardens his heart again. The ninth plague is 3 days of thick, palpable darkness over all of Egypt. People couldn't see each other, couldn't move from their places.
Just complete darkness.
Except In stark contrast, all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings.
That separation again.
Consistently. And throughout this relentless series of judgments, Pharaoh's unyielding resistance is the constant theme. He repeatedly hardens his heart despite the escalating devastation, despite even his own servants pleading with him, you know, "Knowest thou not yet that Egypt is destroyed? Let them go."
So this raises that important question. Why? Why does he keep resisting? What does this hardening of his heart, as the text describes it, really signify? Is it just stubbornness, or is there more to it?
Well, it's profound, isn't it? The text seems to suggest it wasn't just Pharaoh's stubbornness, though that was certainly there. It seems it was also part of a divine strategy to really magnify God's power through these repeated, undeniable miracles.
Okay, so making a bigger point.
Exactly. Each plague was like a direct challenge to the gods and the natural order revered in Egypt. It demonstrated the Lord's absolute sovereignty, not just to the Egyptians, but crucially, also to the Israelites themselves. It solidified their understanding of who their God truly was and prepared them, perhaps, to trust him for the impossible journey ahead.
That makes sense. It's about revelation as much as judgment.
Precisely. And this all leads, inevitably, to the final, most devastating plague.
Yeah.
The death of the firstborn.
But before that happens, God gives these very specific, incredibly detailed instructions for the Passover ritual to Moses and Aaron.
Yes, the instructions were meticulous. Taking an unblemished male lamb.
Right.
Keeping it until the 14th day of the month, killing it at twilight, and then striking its blood on the two side posts and the upper doorpost of their houses.
The blood on the doorposts.
Exactly. And they were to eat its roasted flesh that night with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. And they had to eat it in haste, dressed, and ready to go, with your loins girded, your shoes on your feet, and your staff in your hand. This was designated as the Lord's Passover.
So that when God passed through Egypt to strike the firstborn,
he would pass over the houses marked with the blood. It's this powerful, visceral image of divine protection and distinction based on obedience.
And then came that momentous night. The text says at midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sat on his throne unto the firstborn of the captive that was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of cattle.
A devastating blow. The text emphasizes there was a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, adding starkly, for there was not a house where there was not one dead.
Just unimaginable grief, but in stark contrast among the Israelites, profound peace. The text says, against any of the children of Israel shall not a dog move his tongue, against man or beast.
It powerfully illustrates that clear distinction God made between the two peoples, a separation marked, literally, by life and death.
And Pharaoh's response this time?
Immediate, urgent. He called for Moses and Aaron by night and commanded them, take the Israelites, their flocks, their herds, everything, and get you forth from among my people. The long, arduous struggle was finally over. He even asks them to bless me also.
Wow. After all that resistance. And what's truly remarkable here is the sheer speed of their departure. They took their dough before it was leavened.
Yeah, no time to waste.
Binding their kneading troughs and their clothes upon their shoulders. And incredibly, the text notes the Israelites also borrowed, or perhaps asked for, is a better sense from the Egyptians, jewels of silver and jewels of gold and raiment.
Right, effectively spoiling the Egyptians, just as God had promised Moses earlier in the narrative. It's this fascinating fulfillment of prophecy, almost like turning their years of servitude into a kind of recompense.
The magnitude of the departure is just astounding. They journeyed from Ramses to Sukkoth, and the number given is about 600,000 on foot that were men beside children.
Plus a mixed multitude of other people who went with them, and vast herds of livestock. It was an enormous movement of people. And the sources indicate their total sojourning in Egypt lasted 430 years.
And importantly, God's guidance immediately after they left was very strategic. He didn't lead them the shorter way through the land of the Philistines.
No, because he thought, lest peradventure the people repent when they see war and they return to Egypt.
Right. He knew they weren't ready for that yet. So instead, he led them about through the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. And Moses also took Joseph's bones with him, fulfilling that ancient oath Joseph made his descendants swear, shows a real continuity across generations.
And crucially, right from the start, the Lord provided constant visible guidance for this massive group, a pillar of a cloud by day to lead the way, and a pillar of fire by night to give them light. This divine GPS, if you will, never left them. It was a constant, tangible presence of divine leadership.
So they reached this pivotal moment at the Red Sea, and God actually instructs Israel to encamp in what looks like a totally trapped position, right by the sea with the wilderness behind them.
Exactly, making Pharaoh think they are entangled in the land, the wilderness hath shut them in.
And Pharaoh, hearing they had fled, predictably has a sudden change of heart again. He musters his army, 600 chosen chariots, all of Egypt's chariots and horsemen, and pursues them.
And upon seeing Pharaoh's massive army bearing down on them, the Israelites were, well, understandably terrified. They lamented fiercely to Moses, actually wishing they had stayed in Egypt.
Yeah, they cry out, "Is not this the word that we did tell thee in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness."
It's such a vivid moment. It really illustrates how quickly people can forget even massive deliverance when faced with a new overwhelming threat. That fear is powerful.
It truly is striking, isn't it? Just days, maybe weeks after the miracle of the Passover and the Exodus, fear just completely takes over. It speaks to that very human tendency to focus on the immediate challenge, sometimes forgetting the powerful evidence of past help.
Absolutely.
But Moses' response is incredibly powerful and direct. "Fear ye not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show to you today."
And then comes the miraculous intervention. The angel of God and that pillar of cloud move behind Israel, between them and the Egyptians. It provided darkness to the Egyptians, but light to the Israelites all night, keeping the armies apart.
Creating a barrier.
Yes. And then the truly dramatic parting of the Red Sea. Moses stretches his rod over the sea, and God sends a strong east wind all night long. It makes the sea dry land and the waters divide. They become like a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left.
An actual wall of water.
That's how it's described. And the Israelites walk on dry ground right through the midst of the sea. It's this utterly awe-inspiring act of salvation.
But the Egyptians, blinded by their pursuit, fatally follow them right into the seabed.
Yes. And then God troubled the host of the Egyptians. The text says he took off their chariot wheels, so they drove heavily. They realized, "Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fighteth for them against the Egyptians." But it was too late.
Moses stretches out his hand again, as commanded.
And the sea returns to its full strength at morning. It completely covers the chariots, the horsemen, Pharaoh's entire army. The text explicitly says they remain not so much as one of them.
Total destruction.
Complete. The Israelites saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. And in that moment, the text says, they feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. This led directly to those triumphant songs of Moses and Miriam, celebrating their absolute liberation.
But the journey wasn't over, not by a long shot. Immediate challenges arose in the wilderness. After just 3 days in the wilderness of Shur, they found no water.
Right. Then they find water at a place called Marah, but it's bitter. They can't drink it. The people murmur against Moses.
Of course.
But God shows Moses a tree, which, when he casts it into the waters, makes them sweet. It's like this quick, practical lesson in divine provision coming in unexpected ways right after the massive miracle.
And the people's subsequent murmuring for food, this time in the wilderness of sin, it shows that pattern again. Despite the miracles, their faith was continually tested by basic needs. They start wishing they had died back in Egypt, where, they claim, they did eat bread to the full.
And it's quite a contrast to their previous cries. But again, God miraculously provides. Quails come in the evening, covering the camp. And in the morning, manna, this bread from heaven.
And the instructions for the manna were really specific, weren't they? Gather an omer, about 2 quarts per person daily. No hoarding, except...
Except on the sixth day, gather a double portion for the Sabbath, because none would appear on the seventh day. And there were consequences for disobedience. If you left it overnight, it bred worms and stank. If you looked for it on the Sabbath, you wouldn't find it.
Right, and the description of the manna is quite vivid. Like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. This constant daily provision, it seems like a powerful lesson in dependence on God, day by day.
Absolutely. Then another water crisis emerges at Rephidim. No water again. The people scold Moses fiercely. They're almost ready to stone him. They ask, "Is the Lord among us or not?"
Questioning God's very presence after all that.
Exactly. But God instructs Moses to take his rod, the same one used at the Nile in the Red Sea, and strike the rock at Horeb. Water flowed out for the people to drink. But Moses names the place Massah, meaning temptation, and Meribah, meaning strife, because of their testing God and quarreling. This incident really underscores the people's ongoing struggles with trust and God's consistent, miraculous provision despite it.
And it's also at Rephidim that they face their first battle. Amalek comes and fights with Israel.
Right. Joshua is chosen to lead the fight, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur go up to the top of a nearby hill.
And there's that surprising detail here about Moses' hands influencing the battle.
Yes, it's fascinating. The text says, when Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. But when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed.
So it wasn't just symbolic?
It seems directly connected. And his hands grew heavy, so Aaron and Hur had him sit on a stone, and they supported his hands, one on each side, until sunset.
Teamwork.
Exactly. It highlights the critical role of sustained spiritual intercession and also perhaps community support. Because they held up his hands, Joshua achieved victory over Amalek. God then commanded Moses to record this battle and swore to utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Moses built an altar there, calling it Jehovah Nisi, which means the Lord is my banner, commemorating that divine victory.
So after these harrowing experiences, thirst, hunger, battle, and the continued divine provision, Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, comes to visit him in the wilderness. He brings Zipporah and their two sons, Gershom and Eliezer. Moses recounts everything God had done for Israel.
Right. Jethro rejoices. But then, this is where Jethro makes that incredibly insightful observation, he sees Moses sitting to judge the people from the morning unto the evening. People are lined up all day with their disputes.
Yeah, it must have been exhausting.
Exactly. And Jethro's counsel is blunt. The thing that thou doest is not good.
Mm.
He says, Moses and the people will surely wear away under such a heavy burden. This really raises an important question, doesn't it? About the burdens of leadership and the sheer wisdom of delegation, even when you're on a divinely guided mission.
That's such a vital lesson, even for us today. Moses, despite having direct divine instruction and witnessing incredible miracles, wasn't immune to burnout or just the practical limitations of being a single leader for hundreds of thousands of people. Jethro's insight highlights that effective leadership, even divinely appointed leadership, requires smart organizational design. It requires the courage to delegate, freeing up the main leader for the bigger picture, for strategic guidance, for that crucial connection with the divine, rather than getting bogged down in every single minor dispute.
And Jethro's advice was very practical. He suggested Moses should be the people's representative before God, bringing their causes to him and teaching them the ordinances and laws. But for judging disputes,
you needed help.
Yes. Appoint able men. Men who fear God, are truthful, and hate dishonest gain to serve as rulers of thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Let them judge the small matters day to day. Only the great matters, the really difficult cases, should be brought to Moses.
A clear hierarchy. And what's crucial is that Moses actually listened. He heeded this advice. He chose able men and established this hierarchical system. It made the burden easier for him and for the people. It really demonstrates the practical application of wisdom in leadership, proving that even direct divine guidance doesn't necessarily negate the need for sensible human organization.
A very important point.
Yeah.
Now, in the third month after leaving Egypt, the Israelites arrive and camp at the foot of Mount Sinai, in the wilderness of Sinai. And God calls Moses up the mountain.
And there, God delivers this powerful message for Israel through Moses. He reminds them of what he did to the Egyptians, how he carried them on eagle's wings and brought them to himself.
Yeah.
And then he offers them a covenant. He says, if they obey his voice and keep his covenant, then they will be his peculiar treasure above all people. They'll be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. This isn't just about following rules. It's about establishing this unique, sacred relationship with God.
It's a foundational offer. And the people's response is unanimous and immediate. All that the Lord hath spoken, we will do.
They accept. So following this, preparations begin for God's actual descent onto Mount Sinai. The people are instructed to sanctify themselves for 2 days, wash their clothes, abstain from intimacy. Moses then sets boundaries around the mountain, warning that anyone, even an animal, who touches it must be put to death. It really underscores the holiness and the immense dangerous power of the divine presence about to manifest.
Absolutely. And on the third day, the scene is just incredibly dramatic. The text describes thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount and the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud so that all the people that was in the camp trembled.
You can almost feel it.
Yeah. And Mount Sinai itself is completely covered in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly.
And it was amidst this truly awe-inspiring, terrifying display that God directly revealed the Ten Commandments, spoken from the mountain. These are those foundational laws we know covering worship, reverence for God's name, Sabbath observance, honoring parents, and the core prohibitions against killing, adultery, stealing, false witness, and coveting. These direct words from the divine are just central to establishing the moral and religious conduct for this newly formed nation.
But the people's reaction was one of profound fear. Seeing the thunderings, the lightnings, the smoking mountain, the trumpet sound, they drew back. They asked Moses, "Speak thou with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die."
They were overwhelmed.
Completely. Moses reassures them, though. He says, "Fear not, for God has come to prove you, and that his fear may be before your faces, that ye sin not." It's a test, but also meant to instill lasting reverence.
Okay, so beyond the Ten Commandments spoken directly, God then gave Moses further judgments or laws. These covered a really wide range of social and civil matters, right?
Exactly. A whole societal blueprint. Laws concerning Hebrew servants, how they should be treated and released. Capital offenses like striking a parent or kidnapping. Laws about assault, including the famous eye for eye, tooth for tooth principle, which is about ensuring equitable justice, not escalating vengeance.
Right. Proportional response.
Yes. Also laws about animal damages, theft and restitution, handling deposits, rules about seduction. And crucially, there are these strong protections for the most vulnerable in society, strangers, widows, and the fatherless, with a very clear warning. Ye shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry. It's powerful stuff.
It really is. What else was covered?
Further laws addressed lending money specifically, not charging interest or usury, to fellow Israelites in need. Rules about respecting rulers and God, offerings of first fruits, and the outlining of the three specific annual pilgrimage feasts, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Harvest, or Weeks Pentecost, and the Feast of Ingathering, or Tabernacles. It really highlights the breadth of the societal framework being established, reaching into almost every aspect of life, civil, criminal, social, religious.
Wow, comprehensive. So how was this covenant formally established?
Well, after receiving all these words, Moses comes down, tells the people, and they again respond, "All the words which the Lord hath said will we do." Then we have the formal ratification ceremony. Moses writes down all the words of the Lord. He builds an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Young men offer burnt offerings and sacrifice peace offerings of oxen.
Okay. And then the blood.
Yes, the blood is key. Moses takes half the blood and puts it in basins. The other half he sprinkles on the altar. Then he takes the book of the covenant and reads it aloud to the people. They affirm again, "All that the Lord hath said will we do," and be obedient.
And then the other half of the blood.
He takes that blood from the basins and sprinkles it on the people, declaring, "Behold the blood of the covenant which the Lord hath made with you concerning all these words." This act signifies this deep binding agreement, a covenant literally sealed by blood, uniting God and the people.
That's incredibly potent symbolism.
It is. And then a truly unique moment occurs right after this. Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, Aaron's sons, and 70 of the elders of Israel go up partway on the mountain. And the text says they saw the God of Israel.
They saw God.
That's what it says. It describes something under his feet like a paved work of sapphire stone and, as it were, the body of heaven in his clearness. Incredibly, it adds that God laid not his hand upon the nobles of the children of Israel. Also, they saw God and did eat and drink. They shared a meal in this profound, unveiled divine presence.
Just extraordinary. So following this, Moses ascends the mountain again.
Yes, for another prolonged period. God calls him up higher into the cloud to receive the two tables of stone, the Ten Commandments inscribed by God himself, and also the law and commandments God had written to teach the people. Moses is up there for 40 days and 40 nights, receiving not just the stone tablets, but also the intricate instructions for building the tabernacle.
Right, the tabernacle. This brings us to the concept of the tabernacle itself. It's described as a sanctuary, right? So God could dwell among them.
Exactly. It wasn't just a tent. It was designed as a portable dwelling place for God's manifest presence, built precisely after the pattern that was shown to Moses on the mountain. Every detail was specified. It was meticulously designed to teach Israel about God's holiness, his majesty, and the very precise way he needed to be approached.
So let's talk about some of those details. Within this sacred space, you had central elements like the Ark of the Testimony.
Yes, the Ark. Made of acacia wood, overlaid inside and out with pure gold, with a gold crown or molding around it. It had rings and poles for carrying because it was sacred and shouldn't be touched directly. Inside, eventually, would be placed the tablets of the law, symbolizing God's covenant and word at the heart of his presence.
And on top of it, the mercy seat.
Right. A solid gold cover for the ark, with two cherubim, also of beaten gold, one at each end, facing each other, wings spread upward, overshadowing the mercy seat. This was considered the very place of atonement, where God's presence would reside between the cherubim, symbolizing his throne on earth.
Okay, and other furniture, the table of showbread.
Yes, also acacia wood overlaid with gold, where 12 loaves of bread representing the 12 tribes were to be placed continually before the Lord, symbolizing divine provision and fellowship.
And the lampstand, the menorah.
The candlestick, or menorah, not wood, but pure beaten gold. A central shaft with 6 branches, 3 on each side, forming 7 lamps in total. Intricately decorated with almond blossoms, knobs, and flowers, it was to burn continually, providing light in the holy place, symbolizing divine light, guidance, and perhaps the Spirit of God.
Wow, the level of detail is amazing. What about the tabernacle structure itself?
Equally detailed, the inner layer consisted of 10 main curtains made of fine twined linen, dyed blue, purple, and scarlet, with cherubim skillfully woven into them. These were coupled together with gold clasps.
Okay.
Over this was an outer covering of 11 curtains made of goat's hair, coupled with bronze clasps, and then additional protective coverings of ram skins dyed red, and finally an outer layer of durable skins, possibly badger or sea cow skins. These layers formed the tent itself.
And the framework?
Upright frames of acacia wood, overlaid with gold, set in heavy silver sockets, made from the atonement money collected from the people, all held together by gold-overlaid bars. And crucially, there was an elaborate veil made of the same fine linen and colors as the inner curtains, with cherubim woven in. This veil separated the holy place, containing the lampstand, table, and incense altar, from the most holy place, or Holy of Holies, where only the Ark of the Testimony resided. This veil heavily emphasized the sanctity and separation required to approach God's immediate presence.
Right, that separation between the holy and the most holy. And there were altars, too.
Yes, 2 main ones. Outside the courtyard stood the altar of burnt offering, made of acacia wood overlaid with bronze with horns at the corners. This is where the main sacrifices were offered.
Okay.
Then inside the holy place, just before the veil, stood the smaller altar of incense, made of acacia wood overlaid with pure gold. This was where incense was burned morning and evening, representing the prayers of the people ascending to God.
And a laver for washing.
Yes. Also in the courtyard, between the bronze altar and the tent entrance, a large basin made of bronze, filled with water, for Aaron and his sons, the priests, to wash their hands and feet before ministering at the altar or entering the tent, signifying the need for purification before approaching God.
And the whole thing was enclosed in a courtyard.
Correct. Defined by hangings of fine twined linen, supported by bronze pillars set in bronze sockets with silver hooks and connecting rods. This created an outer sacred precinct around the tabernacle itself.
Just incredible, the precision. And then there were the instructions for the holy garments for Aaron and his sons, the priests, made for glory and for beauty, it says.
Yes, by those specially gifted, the wise-hearted. This included the ephod, a sort of sleeveless vest or apron, intricately woven with gold thread, blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, and fine linen. It had 2 onyx stones set in gold filigree on the shoulder pieces, engraved with the names of the 12 tribes of Israel, 6 on each stone. Aaron wore these on his shoulders for a memorial before the Lord, symbolizing him bearing the tribes into God's presence.
Carrying the people, symbolically.
Exactly. And attached to the ephod, worn over Aaron's heart, was the breastplate of judgment, a square pouch made of the same rich materials doubled over. It contained 12 precious stones, each engraved with the name of one of the tribes, set in gold. This again symbolized bearing the people on his heart before God. And inside the breastplate pouch were the Urim and the Thummim objects used somehow for discerning God's will or judgment.
The Urim and Thummim, mysterious objects. What else?
Under the ephod was the robe of the ephod, woven entirely of blue yarn. Along its hem were alternating pomegranates made of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn and golden bells. The sound of the bells was crucial. It had to be heard when Aaron entered and exited the holy place before the Lord, perhaps signifying life or ensuring the people knew the high priest was ministering acceptably on their behalf.
So the sound was important.
Very. There were also other garments specified, finely embroidered coats or tunics, a turban or mitre for Aaron, with a gold plate inscribed Holiness to the Lord fastened to the front, sashes or girdles, and linen undergarments or breeches for both Aaron and his sons to ensure modesty and cover their nakedness during service. All these garments served to set apart the priests for their sacred mediatorial role.
And one of the most compelling aspects detailed here is the elaborate consecration ceremony for Aaron and his sons to actually become priests. It wasn't just putting on the clothes.
Not at all. It was a multi-day, meticulous process described in detail later, but planned here. It involved ritual washing, anointing with specially compounded holy oil, dressing them in these specific holy garments, and offering a complex series of specific sacrifices, sin offerings, burnt offerings, and the unique ram of consecration. Blood from this ram was applied to the right earlobe, right thumb, and right big toe of Aaron and his sons, signifying the consecration of their hearing, their actions, and their walk to God's service. It underscored the immense holiness and weight of their calling.
Preparing individuals for sacred service in such a detailed way.
Precisely. And the divine instructions didn't stop with the objects and clothes. God specifically appointed the master craftsman who would oversee the construction. Bezaleel, from the tribe of Judah, is highlighted. God says he filled him with the Spirit of God, in wisdom and in understanding and in knowledge and in all manner of workmanship, to devise cunning works, to work in gold and in silver and in brass and in cutting of stones and in carving of timber.
So skill and craftsmanship are seen as divine gifts.
Absolutely. And he also appointed Aholiab from the tribe of Dan to work with him and gave wisdom to all the other gifted artisans who would actually build everything. It highlights that practical skill is valued and essential for carrying out God's purposes.
And then what's truly surprising, maybe, is the people's response when it came time to gather the materials.
Oh, it's remarkable. Moses calls for contributions: gold, silver, bronze, yarns, linens, skins, wood, oil, spices, precious stones, whatever people were willing to bring. And the response was overwhelming generosity. The people, both men and women, whose hearts were stirred, brought so much bracelets, earrings, rings, gold ornaments, silver, bronze, fabrics, everything needed. The leaders brought the precious stones and spices. They brought much more than enough for the service of the work which the Lord commanded to make.
More than enough.
So much more that Moses actually had to issue a command throughout the camp for them to stop bringing offerings. Let neither man nor woman make any more work for the offering of the sanctuary. So the people were restrained from bringing. It truly highlights the people's willing spirit at that moment, their eagerness to contribute tangibly to this dwelling place for God's presence among them.
That's an amazing detail.
Yeah.
So finally, all the work was completed.
Yes. Bezaleel, Aholiab, and all the skilled workers made everything precisely as the Lord had commanded Moses. Every detail of the tabernacle, its furnishings, the courtyard, the priestly garments, it was all done according to the pattern shown on the mountain. Moses inspects all the finished work, confirms it matches the command, and then he blessed them.
And then the final culminating moment, setting it all up.
Exactly. On the first day of the first month of the second year after leaving Egypt, Moses erected the tabernacle. He set up the sockets, the frames, the bars, spread the tent coverings over it, put the testimony, the tablets into the ark, placed the mercy seat on top, brought the ark into the tabernacle, and hung the separating veil. He arranged the table and the bread, set up the lampstand and lit the lamps, placed the golden incense altar before the veil and burned incense, set up the screen for the tent door.
Meticulously following the plan.
Every step. Then he placed the altar of burnt offering in the courtyard, offered sacrifices on it, set up the laver, and filled it with water for washing. He set up the courtyard hangings all around. So Moses finished the work.
And then?
Then the divine acceptance. The cloud covered the tent of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. The visible manifestation of God's presence was so powerful, so overwhelming, that Moses himself was not able to enter into the tent of the congregation because the cloud abode thereon and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle.
Wow, God literally moved in.
He did. And the profound significance of that cloud by day and the fire within it by night cannot be overstated. They weren't just symbols. They were the visible, undeniable manifestation of God's presence and leadership, guiding the Israelites throughout all their subsequent journeys in the wilderness. The text concludes by saying, "For the cloud of the Lord was upon the tabernacle by day, and fire was on it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. When the cloud lifted, they moved. When it settled, they camped."
Following God's direct, palpable lead.
Exactly. It was God's direct, visible leadership and protection for his people on the move, a constant signal for their every step.
So you've just taken this deep dive with us into an absolutely extraordinary journey. I mean, from enslavement to liberation, from being just a wandering multitude to becoming this divinely ordered nation, complete with a physical manifestation of God's own presence right there at its core.
Yeah, it's quite the narrative. So what does this all mean for us looking back? I think this narrative really illustrates the incredible detail involved in establishing or reestablishing a relationship between the divine and a community. It shows us not just grand sweeping miracles, but also these meticulous instructions for structure, for ritual, for daily living.
Mm-hmm.
It highlights the immense importance placed on covenant, on obedience, and on this concept of a tangible, even if symbolic, divine dwelling among the people, providing both protection and moment-by-moment guidance.
Okay, so here's a provocative thought for you to consider as you continue your own journey of discovery. How does that constant, visible presence, the cloud by day and the fire by night, guiding an entire nation through a harsh wilderness, how does that speak to, perhaps, the deep human longing we all have for clear direction and purpose? Especially when we're faced with daunting and uncertain paths in our own lives, what can we maybe learn about enduring commitment through difficulty from this ancient narrative of a people on the move, always looking to that divine presence for their very next step?